Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Each week on Wednesdays, we invite some of the top political journalists in the state to join us as part of the Dakota Political Junkies. Today, we welcome Seth Tupper from the Rapid City Journal. Seth, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get started. I think Jonathan Ellis is going to join us here in a few minutes, but let's start with some of the races in the state of South Dakota that we're already looking at and how the money rolls in, and this is something that has captured your curiosity as well. What are you digging into?
I've been looking at the U.S. House race lately because Chantel Krebs, Secretary of State, recently filed with the Federal Elections Commission her first quarter fundraising, and she raised, I forget the exact number, around $130,000. And she's so far in the race against Dusty Johnson for the Republican nomination for that seat, which will be vacated by Kristi Noem, current representative, because she's going to run for governor. But, Dusty has had two quarters of fundraising. He declared his candidacy earlier, and but if you compare apples to apples and compare each of their first quarters, Chantel Krebs had a better first quarter of fundraising than Dusty did. And in looking at some of the donors, so you can explain a lot of it with Rapid City. Chantel Krebs raised quite a bit more money from quite a few more donors with Rapid City addresses mm-hmm. than Dusty Johnson did. And it's pretty early to make any conclusions from that. But one of the theories of that race, I think, that I've wondered about from the start is that, you know, Dusty Johnson strikes me as a pretty moderate Republican and somebody who has, been in the Republican Party a long time, made a lot of relationships, spoken at a lot of Republican fundraising events. And I think if Chantel Krebs is going to beat him, maybe one of the ways to do that would be to outflank him, run as the more conservative option, which if she does that, you would expect her to receive more support from West River and from Rapid City, where there's not only a lot of Republicans, but more conservative Republicans, I think, than there are East River. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Do you think that's something that she's poised to do to sort of reach the more conservative South Dakotans in the state?
I would guess so, but as I said, you know, it's pretty early, obviously, with the election not till next year. She just got in not that long ago. She's only had one quarter of fundraising, and of course, we don't know where the race is going to go yet. But I did notice that when the legislature was debating, a couple of high-profile gun bills this session, one that would have allowed, guns and certain people to carry guns in the Capitol, but that was vetoed, and then also another bill that would have allowed people to carry concealed weapons without having to get a permit. She took pretty strong stances on those and aligned herself with various gun groups that were supporting those bills. And so I took that maybe as a sign that she's going to run as somebody who's more conservative possibly than her opponent, which, you know, might be a winning strategy in a primary in South Dakota where, in an off year, a non-presidential election year, you would expect that turnout maybe will be down, and a lot of the voters in a Republican House primary are going to be only the most dedicated, the most conservative type of voters. So,
sure.
That said, Dusty Johnson hasn't done poorly. He's raised over $200,000, and perhaps he hasn't focused on West River yet, or he hasn't. You know, maybe she sent more mailers and did more events here than he did. I don't know. It's pretty early. But again, that's, you know, when you look at those early signs, you wonder if that's the position that Chantel Krebs is gonna take.
All right. Let's bring Jonathan Ellis into the conversation now from the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. Jonathan, welcome.
Sorry, I'm tardy.
That's all right. It's allowed. And Seth and I have been talking about some of the early, foreshadowing of the race between Chantel Krebs and Dusty Johnson, and too early to tell much, but Seth has been following up on that and looking at where some of that money is coming from and Chantel Krebs's strength in the Rapid City area for right now. And you had been looking at some other early signs for how races might go. What do you want to talk about there?
Well, yeah, and I can't wait to read what Seth has got so I don't have to do that research myself. But You know, I guess on the governor's side, I mean, we've been looking at the positioning that's taking place between the two, what we would consider the two GOP heavyweights there, and that'd be Attorney General Marty Jackley, Representative Kristi Noem. And so we're kind of in the midst of this Lincoln Day dinner gauntlet that the candidates have to run through, and these are the county dinners that are put on by the parties. And so, you know, it's an opportunity for the candidates to get out to these dinners and meet the real activists who are going to be, as Seth was talking about, so the real ones who show up for the primaries, whether it's an off year or not. And so these are the people the candidates will be wanting to talk to. You know, there's actually some skirmishing going on behind the scenes with regard to what, you know, that race. I mean, I think Kristi Noem, out of the blue, asked U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to talk about the rising violence in South Dakota, which was sort of a shot, I think, at Marty Jackley, who's sort of the state's top law enforcement officer and has been for a number of years now. And over that time period, there has been, there's been a fairly big increase in certain types of crimes. And I think that was Kristi Noem's attempt to take a shot at Marty Jackley, that this has happened on his watch. And so we've seen some positioning with regard to crime in South Dakota and whether that's going to be an issue in the next governor's race, and it sounds like it certainly might be.
Which could be, it seems like a very direct shot as well, not necessarily positioning on the policies like maybe we're seeing from Chantel Krebs, but a direct look at the candidate and what you want to say about what he's been up to.
Yeah, I mean, candidate's record is always a fair game, and in this case, Kristi Noem's record, whether or not if Congress can't get anything done with regard to health reform or tax reform, or if Congress just gets nothing done, I mean, her record is going to be fair game as well. Mm-hmm. It's just as Marty Jackley is going to be. So these things, these will be, both of those issues, no doubt, will be play a role in the upcoming primary, which, you know, is only... And we're going to be in the thick of it in a year, so it's
yeah.
coming up.
So Jonathan, let's talk about that. How Jackley responded? What did, you know? He surely had to have some thoughts about sort of that conversation.
Well, he's done. I mean, what he did was, he immediately went out to Washington and met with Jeff Sessions. He issued a press release saying Sessions is doing a great job, and he loved, commended him on his commitment to fighting crime. He then issued his report on statistics, 2016 crime statistics, which, while showing an increase certainly in methamphetamine and drug arrests, I believe, there was a decrease, however, in violent crime. So that was Jackley's response, immediate response to Noem's attack, or I don't want to say use the word attack, but highlighting the high crime in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Seth, thoughts on Noem and Jackley? Jackley and Noem at this point, this early time?
Yeah, I have similar thoughts to Jonathan. That was a shot by Noem, probably politically calculated. Also realizing that, crime was up in South Dakota, it does seem to be a legitimate problem. But, I've heard in the past, one of the things that Kristi Noem has focused on in Congress is sex trafficking and
right.
opposing bills to try to, limit that practice and rein it in. And I've heard Marty Jackley in the past throw out a line that, well, some people talk about sex trafficking, and then some of us prosecute sex traffickers. And so I think that's probably going to be his, if there's going to be a fight over has the top law and order official in South Dakota been law and order enough, I mean, he's going to have a lot of things to fall back on.
Right.
Obviously, he's the state's top prosecutor. He's put a lot of people in prison. He's prosecuted a lot of cases, so... So I thought it was interesting that Kristi Noem picked that as an issue to highlight, because I think the deeper she digs into that, the more defenses that Jackley is going to be able to pull out.
It will be interesting to follow that forward. And Jonathan, let's talk about high-profile crime in speeding in South Dakota. I'm just kind of being facetious there. But all right,
yeah,
so last time...
You're one of those. I hear you're one of the criminals.
Don't start making me defend my driving record again, because I literally am one of the slowest drivers. Just one time I got a speeding ticket, and one time I got pulled over and didn't get a speeding ticket. So anyway, I've been very careful since then. Last time we talked, you were doing some work looking at those numbers from the South Dakota Highway Patrol. Give us a little background and then tell us what's new.
Well, sure. We did a story, it's been a couple weeks now ago, on just how many speeding tickets the Highway Patrol has given out since the speed limit went to 80 miles per hour on April 1st. And we compared, we did a comparison before the speed limit went in, a new speed limit, and then a comparable time afterwards. And that analysis showed that there was quite an upsurge in the number of tickets that had been given after new speeding law. Now, at the time, what we didn't have was how fast motorists were actually going. The Highway Patrol did not want to release the speeds at which people were traveling and the zones they were traveling in. So we appealed that to the Office of Hearing Examiners, and actually the Highway Patrol went ahead and relented and gave us the speeds, which quite fascinating, actually. And I think that what we'll have this story probably in the next week or so as we get some more analysis into the data. But certainly people are driving faster. Now, that would, you'd say, well, sure, the speed limit went up to 80, but they're driving. They're kind of confirming what safety experts had warned, that, hey, if you increase the speed, people aren't just going to stay at that speed. They'll drive even faster than they were before. And the initial analysis of the data that we've done would certainly confirm that is correct. People are being cited for driving at much higher speeds than they were prior to the new speed limits. So that's something we're working on for an upcoming project here.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with the Dakota Political Junkies. This week it's Jonathan Ellis, and you can read his work at argusleader.com. And then we've got Seth Tupper from Rapid City, and you can read his work at rapidcityjournal.com. And Seth, let's switch over to some of the updates really coming out of Pierre and looking at summer studies and land swaps. And let's just start with this Spearfish Canyon game fish and parks land swap being put on pause. We've talked about it, I think, plenty on the show, but I'm wondering what the reaction has been West River of the pause.
Well, it's been a cautious celebration, I would say. The public sentiment here has been overwhelmingly against a state park in Spearfish Canyon. And so I think people are happy that it seems to have lost momentum. But at the same time, the word pause certainly infers that it could be restarted in the future. So it's been cautiously celebratory. But this whole issue has been so interesting to me. I think, as a case study in political science, it's you would think that if a governor proposed to protect a universally beloved landscape as a state park, that would be something that everybody would support. And so it was really interesting to watch as public sentiment out here went against it, because people like Spearfish Canyon the way it is. They're actually afraid that a lot of people are afraid that a state park would be overdevelopment for Spearfish Canyon. And you had a coalition of people from all political stripes, conservative, liberal, independent, coming together in a big group to oppose this plan and coming to the defense of the federal government, which now owns much of Spearfish Canyon, against the state government, which was, you could never have predicted any of that at the start of this, I don't think. And so, and at the start of all this planning, the governor was for a state park, his administration was behind it, the three congressional delegates were behind it, and I'll freely admit, at that point, I thought, well, this is a done deal, but it's really a credit to the people who opposed it, and it's a really interesting case study in political activism, the way that people were able to turn the tide on this issue and turn back something that had so much top-level support.
What do you think people were responding to so strongly? Because it wasn't necessarily politics when you talk about which, federal government versus state, but they were responding to something else that was very core and got a lot of people engaged. Seth, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what it is a lot of people here, not only people who grew up here, but people who just visited the Black Hills when they were young, they've always been used to Spearfish Canyon being a place that you could go to freely. Before the state owned much of anything in the canyon, the state now owns Rufflock Falls. It used to be owned by Homestake Mining Company. It's always been a very undeveloped area where you could just walk in there, and it was very natural. And I think, people have a very deep-rooted love of Spearfish Canyon for that reason, of it being one of the last kind of undeveloped, relatively undeveloped places in the Black Hills, even to the extent of just, modern amenities and things like that. I mean, it's a lot less developed than, say, Custer State Park. And I think people just really wanted to hold on to that, and they decided that we're drawing the line here, and we want to have a place that's not overrun with out-of-state tourists all the time, like a lot of people think Custer State Park is. And so it was a very, very localized issue that really struck at people's hearts. Mm. And as I said, it'd been pretty tough for any bureaucrat and peer to predict something like that at the outset of this.
As we had the conversation on this show, Seth, we got a couple comments via email from folks who said they didn't want it to see it go the way Custer went. And,
right.
You know, I didn't never experienced Custer before it is, Custer State Park before it is what it is now. But there was some memory of, you know, being a, you know, having the campgrounds more, or you could camp more accessibly is what one gentleman told me. You didn't have to be in the state reservation system, and it was harder to get a place to go. So they had some collective memory there as well.
Yeah, and I can tell you from personal experience, I mean, I still love Custer State Park, and a lot of people do.
Right.
You go there in the heat of the summer, and you're driving around a long time looking for a place to park, and there are cars overflowing out of the parking lot, down the roads, out to the park entrance, and you know, a lot of those people are out of state, and so for locals, some of them feel like we've kind of ceded that park to out-of-state tourists, and a lot of people feel like we haven't done that with Spearfish Canyon, and they want to sort of protect that from happening, and so, yeah, and they were very successful at it.
Jonathan, you want to quickly talk about summer studies and what has kind of come up with Meandering Waters and different things that the lawmakers might look at over the summer?
Well, this is all in response to a Supreme Court decision from last month that basically said that the game, fish, and parks can't allow people onto water over private property. It's really in relation to a couple of sloughs up north in Dade County. And basically, unless the legislature does something to empower game, fish, and parks to do that. You know, the summer study, there obviously will be some legislation that comes with that. But it's a very controversial issue. I mean, certainly the hunters and anglers want access to these waters. The private landowners whose land now has water on it, they have some issues with that. And certainly if you look at the Supreme Court ruling, the people who were accessing the landowners and who were accessing the waters there were really not being good neighbors. They were leaving garbage behind and things like that, and playing loud music and having parties out there. So no wonder the landowners got a little upset. So, it's a controversial issue, and we'll see what the legislature comes from the legislative summer session. But my guess is it's going to be something we'll be hearing a lot of in the next session.
All right. Seth, any last thoughts on summer? What's going on over the summer that you're looking at?
Well, I'm just glad that topic, the lakes issue, became a summer study because, boy, if there's ever a complex issue that needed study, some of these places are, you know, former farmland that became lakes that you could run a boat on. And so are those public lakes or is it still private property? And that's that really needs some study. And so I'm glad the legislature picked that, and I'll be interested to hear what they come up with.
In a problem that's been around, but nobody has really been able to come to consensus on. It's going to take some really intense compromise, perhaps.
After litigation, yes.
And perhaps litigation. Well, we'll be talking about that frequently, I guess. And before I let you guys go, today's the 24 years since the plane carrying South Dakota Governor George Mikkelsen and others crashed. And I thought we would remember our Dakota Political Junkies conversation from last year during this week. And we had Kevin Wooster with us that day. And we were talking about sort of the impact that had on journalists. So let's listen for a minute.
Well, I remember watching, I looked up at Deborah Wade Schmidt, and I saw her, and she'd write, her face was beet red, and she'd write, and then she'd fan her face because she was trying to collect herself and keep it together while she was writing it, because so many of us knew him on such a personal basis. He was so approachable. But not just the governor. I also remember Larry Fuller, who was the publisher at the time, getting us together. And after the meeting, I heard him sitting in his office saying, "Oh, Berkey, Berkey." And that was Dave Berkland, the banker there in Sioux Falls that Fuller knew well. And so everybody had an indication and a direct link like that. With me, it was Rowan Dolly, who was the governor's economic commissioner and who was just a kid from Presho, you know, that I knew my home county, and he was a little younger than I was. And And reporters had to work through that. And we worked through that grief process ourselves as I followed the way that the governor had gone from his cabin on Lake Ponson on Sunday to when he drove back to Pier and then flew out, you know, with the other guys on the Mitsubishi, and you know, followed it back after the Hilland State, and they had the services at the Capitol and a funeral caravan from Pier back to Brookings, where, you know, where he was laid to rest, and the people gathered along the way, from Native Americans to little BFW groups along the road in Highmore or Herald or, you know, Cavour, as they passed. It was, you just had to keep collecting yourself and putting yourself together. And when I got done at the end of the week, I sat alone by myself in my room and bawled. And it's funny how it still comes back.
And that's the voice of Kevin Wooster from last year during this week, as we remember the plane crash that killed South Dakota Governor George Mikkelsen and others. That's our Dakota Political Junkies for today. Seth Tupper, RapidCityJournal.com. You can find his work there. Seth, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Jonathan Ellis, Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Go to ArgusLeader.com to find Jonathan's work. You can follow them both on Twitter as well. Jonathan, we appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.